Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campuses of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American Bar Association's Energy, Environmental Markets, and Finance Committee and American University's Washington College of Law. This is the Hot Air Show. I'm your host, Chris Barrett. This is your source for energy and climate news and editorial. Today, I have with me...
I'm Kevin Book from Clearview Energy Partners.
I'm Jean Chemnick from Greenwire.
Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen.
And we have remotely... Folks, today we're establishing a feat of technical sophistication in having folks call and join us in the show in ways we haven't before. We're lucky enough to have Jackie on the phone, and hopefully everyone will get her input in this discussion. Today we're going to be talking about the newly released Obama climate plan, his speech, and the energy efficiency bill in the Senate. And so to start, Jean, why don't you give us a sense on what you thought the overall expectations were and satisfaction against those expectations of the various stakeholder communities in D.C. Were people satisfied, in your view, with the Obama climate plan?
I think the environmental community was very excited about it. I mean, I think they're waiting for it to be implemented now, but all of them kind of turned out on the 25th of June, and they were all, it was kind of a garden party feeling, and everybody said that they were very excited that this had finally, you know, moved to the front burner after not really being on the front burner for
some time. Now, Tyson, did you have your hat at that garden party?
We did not. We take a more realistic view. The problem is that the D.C. environmental community has been beaten down and is so dejected that all they have to hear is our president mentioned the words climate change, and they get giddy with excitement. And so we saw press release after press release fawning over the president's speech. It was a great speech, but once you break down the details of that speech, it's a little less inspiring. The big focus of the speech, obviously, was the EPA is going to issue new rules over power plants. Well, that wasn't new news. It happened over a year ago. And in April, the administration quietly withdrew those rules under significant industry criticism. So it wasn't an unveiling of a brand new program. It was retweaking rules that had already been introduced. And actually, we're behind schedule because of the withdrawal of those rules earlier this year.
From the NAACP's view, was there anything new in the plan that you didn't expect that you saw? It looks like we might be having technical difficulties.
Jackie,
you still with us?
You still with us? It appears we've run into technical difficulties on the show. Well, it's to be expected. Kevin,
yes.
Your view. Now that we're going on the table.
I would not deign to speak on behalf of the NAACP. However, I would agree with a lot of what Tyson said. We had been expecting to hear about new source performance standards for existing coal units. We'd been expecting it for a long time, pretty much since last November. We heard about them, but they weren't news. There was a settlement agreement in 2010 that said that they were coming, and we knew they were coming. We'd been expecting to hear a lot about energy efficiency. There's an energy efficiency bill that we'll be talking about later in this show. And he talked about energy efficiency as a solution, but that too, not news. What was important, though, was that it was on the front burner. The symbolic value of making this real by actually saying the regulatory rubber was going to hit the road, and the first two speeches of the year weren't just pretty words, that was valuable. That meant that it wasn't just potential energy, it's really going to happen now, at least until it slows down in court and almost doesn't happen.
Well, it is disappointing that things can enter the realm of D.C. and immediately be expected to be bogged down in court, but it is highly pragmatic and unfortunately the law of the land as it would be. The litigation around this is likely to last for some time. And it's fascinating because if what we've seen with the cross-state air pollution rule and the clean air interstate rule, and you know, even to a certain degree, parts of the NOx-CIP call. We can keep going back in time. Yeah, don't forget mercury to stay current. But it can get disappointing when we look at what litigation can do to some of these issues. At the same time, you know, it is a brave new world that EPA is going down. We were lucky enough to have the new EPA Administrator Gina Carthy on the show not too long ago. And Administrator McCarthy, seemed to indicate that, you know, they recognized that they had quite a job ahead of them and that that litigation was coming, but they could push forth. To your point, putting it on the front burner, making it symbolic, while that might not, you know, directly impact the litigations that are going forth, do you foresee that creating any other headwinds on the political front or the regulatory front that might be helpful?
To the contrary. With Gina McCarthy still waiting in the wings, they decided to move it to the front burner anyway. A pragmatist might have said, well, you know, she's already at the EPA, she's already regulating, she's already there, and the EPA is running without any loss of continuity, so why not sacrifice her? But they weren't sacrificing her. They were bludgeoning ahead in the face of criticism. It sure doesn't look like they intend to be stopped. What they intend to do is continue what they've been doing, which is not giving everybody anything like everything they want, just some of everything they want. Both sides get a little something. That give a little, take a little practice started in the middle of the last term seems to be going forward. This is going to be one of the takes, though.
Interesting. Anybody else? Is this going to continue as give a little, take a little? Is this going to continue kind of, you know, insider horse trading in and around the regulatory framework on this? What I'm hearing Kevin say is that the crown jewel of the Obama climate plan looks good in a speech, but is unlikely to glitter anytime soon.
Well, I think the administration's roadmap for success was built with the blueprints of their greenhouse gas emission rules over tailpipe emissions, where they actively collaborated with the automobile industry to the dismay of Darrell Issa, right, who tried to, or I think he held a hearing to investigate whether or not there was improper dialogue behind the scenes between the administration and the auto industry. The problem is replicating what that collaborative effort with industry with the utility industry is next to impossible because of the huge diversity of fuel mixes and cultures and other aspects of the utility industry. The one thing that is of interest is Southern Company, you know, one of the old school utilities, gave $100,000 of its shareholder money to Obama's second inauguration. And that, to me, shows that Southern Company, you know, look, they've got an $8 billion loan guarantee in the hopper. They've got a clean coal unit, the Kemper unit that's got federal money. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars in smart grid money. So they love the Obama administration for all of this. But what that $100,000 contribution tells me is that they're willing to throw their hat in the ring to talk about EPA regs as well. And so the question is where old school utilities like Southern are going to be as Gina McCarthy and her team go forward on EPA regs. That's going to be the big wild card.
At that, I'll just pause and say, unfortunately, we lost Jackie with the NAACP, and we'll look forward to having her live on one of the next shows. She got pulled away on business, and we miss her company, but we'll see her soon. To your point, it's hard to get together the patchwork. It's interesting that the money is now flowing. But wouldn't the conventional wisdom in DCG and just say they're beginning to spread it around both ways? It was clear that, you know, there's another 4 years with this administration. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, 100,000, even PAC land, is not chump change.
I'm sorry. We're talking about Southern Company and its support for... Well, I don't know. I mean, just getting back a little to what he said, I think that what I tend to hear that it really is the difference between automobile manufacturers and their interest in working with the administration on regs versus utilities is that there is much more similarity in the automobile industry, and so that they have a lot of the same interests, whereas, you know, in utilities you have a very diverse you know, group of companies with very competing interests, and you might have some that are so reliant on coal that they, you know, that they'd want a rule that was structured a certain way versus others that are, you know, heavier on natural gas or nuclear or some other technology. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, the question
I,
was
I just
whether
couldn't quite
did you take note like Tyson did when Southern Company gave that size of contribution, or you know, did it seem like normal spreading it around?
And they were the only utility to contribute.
I think that, I mean, I saw that story and I didn't write that story, but that is an interesting, that's an interesting, it's an interesting tidbit that might be telling.
Kevin, did you take note?
Utilities have always been pretty good at giving to both sides. The reason is that they have to live where they work with the people who are in charge, whoever those people may be. And if you look at where EEI has come down, EEI, the Edison Electric Institute, is incredibly fragmented in terms of the dirties and the cleans, or call them the conventionals and the news, however you want to do it.
The dirties and the cleans.
I mean, obviously, if we had a lot of electric utility clients, I might say the goods and the betters. But in any case, the point is that there are different fuel mixes, different entrenched supply chains, different investments that have been made, and so there's different goals, and that's why you saw so much fragmentation on the MATS rule. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the EEI did put out a white paper, which I think you can't find on their website anymore, but it's still resourcefully retained by the Wall Street Journal on their site, which discussed using the flexible mechanism under Section 111D mm-hmm. of the Clean Air Act as a way to improve upon the idea of a single-size, one-size-fits-all standard, as had been previously discussed and proposed.
And for Clean Air Act wonks out there, 111D is everybody's favorite section that through it might allow for some type of market-based mechanism that would, you know, in Eric Harling's breach the fence line, essentially, allow for units to be regulated collectively as opposed to distinct fence lines around each unit, each permit, and so on. And it's an interesting, you know, it's in the ongoing discussion about market-based mechanisms, flexibilities, how can we do it? And a lot of this, and part of the excitement, you know, in my mind, is that when the expectations on what Congress can accomplish are so low, that anything that's put forth on the regulatory front that looks to have strong winds behind it from the Oval Office is, you know, going to be one of, you know, if not likely to happen, at least likely to be focused on and likely to move forward. Is all of this excitement in your all's mind derivative of just low expectations from Congress?
Sure, there's clearly low expectations. You know, the challenge is going to be how you get the fact-free zone elements of D.C., the interest groups that don't really care about a collaborative compromise effort to get some sort of national policy in place to deal with greenhouse gas emissions, but rather just throw bombs at any sort of regulatory effort, no matter what the details are. And that's going to be the problem. This debate cannot be framed of the EPA is doing this and environmental groups are saying this. Where are the utilities? There has to be a more common voice, and that's going to be the big wild card, because it can't just be environmentalists saying these rules are good. You're going to have some industry stakeholders with something on the line to take a more public stand to promote this, to try and neutralize some of those bomb-throwing entities out there.
And with those bombs, you know, one would argue with how polarized we've become in this town that even the two parties' efforts, I mean, are we going to get anywhere if one party is effectively colored the anti-science party and one color is effectively colored the anti-job party? You know, both sides are working to try to push the extreme framing in the debate. That's not really going to get us anywhere. You seem to be remarking that, you know, similar to what we saw in the past, that it's going to take Edison industry coalitions, you know, basically, you know, Edison, Narouk, you know, the load-serving entities around the country who all have jurisdictional interests in what's going on to get together before this moves forward. The question is can that happen through an EPA regulatory process? A lot of folks would say yes. What do you guys think?
I think if it's going to happen, I think Gina McCarthy is the capable person to do it. But it remains to be seen. I obviously hope that that's going to happen.
Yeah. They're going to do these stakeholder meetings. I mean, that was part of Obama's vision for how the existing source, you know, 111D standard would be written. And I guess that, you know, Cycle said that that will start in the fall. I don't know what that will look like. I mean, I'm told that that, well, you know, I mean, are they going to bring them in tranches? And this is the coal guys. We're going to have coal guy Tuesday.
More garden parties, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm interested how that will work. But it seems to me that you're going to end up with very, very different suggestions for how to structure the rule from very different stakeholder groups. So I'm curious about how that works.
I think they can do it, Chris, and I think they're going to do it, and I think it's because no one else has done anything. Of course, that was a low bar to say, if Congress does nothing, I'm going to do what I was already going to do. But it's easy to keep promises that are already in process.
The brilliance of framing.
Yes, it's set low expectations and exceed them. Well, but look, it's a fight, and once proposed, there's going to be litigation, and the question is who defends the litigation from EPA's perspective, who defends the rule. Obviously, they want to be there to defend the rule in court. To do that, they have to architect a rule that looks like it meets with the principles of the law and also gets at least something like approval in their stakeholder sessions. So those stakeholder sessions aren't a particularly meaningful give. They had to happen. Not only did they have to happen, if you're smart, you'd want to have them, and you'd want to have a lot of them so that you could look to the administrative record and say, here were the comments we received and here is how we addressed them. Better to try to negate them through the rulemaking process than to have to validate a head-to-head controversy in court.
Well, it's we certainly see that the D.C. Circuit has built a reputation over the last 15 years, especially as being particularly black letter with their read of the law, and that administrative record can be very important, especially since there's a lot of Chevron deference, as it might be, that needs to be granted here in terms of, going into new areas and new interpretations of the Act. At the same time, a lot of folks, I do think, and what was interesting about the nomination process with Administrator McCarthy is how many people who were remarkably polarized in their view of the politics of the situation couldn't help but say, she's charming and remarkably pragmatic, and she understands these issues hands down without question. So there seems to be a sense that if anybody can get it done, we now have the leadership in place at EPA that can do it. Whether we get full the way through and if it ends up looking like we're seeing in other places like California, Reggie, and so on, who knows? And then that's the other big question here is how can those existing systems get pulled in or be insulated from or interact with a new federal system? One thing that I'll point out that was also remarkable is we saw recently a circuit court make a fairly unit-specific decision on Section 126 of the Act. We don't have the cross-state air pollution rule in place, but we have courts weighing in very specifically about specific units. It leaves an interesting dynamic out there that cannot stay in its present state, that's for sure. Now, with EPA being busy, and it appears several other agencies, being busy on the energy front, Congress is sitting here asking themselves, can we get anything across the finish line? And instead of looking at, let's get a comprehensive energy bill out of committee, it seems to be that we are taking a look at the present energy efficiency bill that came out of committee and asking the question, how bigger can that table of contents get? In DC parlance, it's becoming a Christmas tree. What are the folks around the room, what are your thoughts on the Sheehan Portman bill? Are we going to see that bill actually get to the floor? And as Reid suggested, as Senator Reid suggested, amendments across the board, including everybody's favorite topic, the Keystone Pipeline.
Well, there's already been a whip count on the potential Keystone Amendment, and it doesn't have the votes at this point. The thing about the Shaheen-Portman bill is that it started off, a couple years ago as a pretty solid piece of legislation, and it's been so watered down that, it's not going to take us backwards, but it's not going to take those important, easy steps on energy efficiency that we need to see. I mean, a perfect example is last month, they stripped out this $350 million program over 10 years for the federal government to get into more natural gas and electric vehicles. So you had fiscal conservatives saying $350 million over 10 years is too much to spend, and meanwhile their conservative base just passed a $196 billion farm bill. So I don't really understand how the economics of basic energy efficiency proposals are getting hammered as being irresponsible for the deficit. It's unfortunate.
Well, I mean, Tyson raises an interesting point. When we're passing things like the Farm Bill at the scale that it is, or not passing as it might be, or arguing about, but when we're considering spending that amount of money, to have small provisions being kind of chipped at and knocked off of bills for programs that are a drop in the bucket, DC budget-wise, is this just grandstanding? Is that what we're seeing here?
I would say this is a real bill that has a chance of really being stopped by politics. But this is one thing that everybody agrees on. It has been diluted. The loan guarantee program was stripped out. Other aspects of the bill have been removed. But this is an area of real consensus. Everybody, I think, at every level in America is sick of paying high prices for energy. And industrial energy efficiency is a major competitiveness mechanism for the U.S. and its increasing operations overseas in export trade. So this is the kind of thing everybody agrees on. So what you'll have is a tremendous barometer. To Tyson's point, though, Keystone isn't going to be the thing that fouls the mix. The 62 votes on a budget resolution that never was going to pass were 62 free votes. Anybody who wanted to take political cover and say, I was for Keystone before I did nothing about it, or I was against it later, can do so, and did. So those 62 votes were not real. That isn't what you have to worry about. What you have to worry about are precisely the kinds of fights that you're bringing up, Chris, which are these little nitpicking arguments about small things and missing the potential for a big target.
Is that, Gene, from your view, are we going to continue to nitpick on this? I mean, it seems that anything that could make for a good stump speech, regardless of what side of the aisle we're talking about, is getting championed. And it's interesting because, you know, all congressional members love to champion things that are happening in their own district. Do you see, now that the appropriations process has gotten just so befuddled over the last decade, do you believe that, you know, we're seeing what used to happen on a line item basis in appropriations beginning to happen in major legislation now, where everyone is just kind of needling away?
Well, I think, I mean, the House in particular is going to spend this week doing a number of votes that would never probably make it in the Senate, but they're doing it because they're about to go home for August recess and can talk about it. And there's an EPA bill on the floor sometime this week that would make DOE responsible for deciding whether or not EPA's rules are too costly to the energy sector, which, I mean, that has no future in the Senate, really, probably. I mean, that's the idea. But they'll be able to pass this, and they'll talk about it a lot.
It's interesting.
Same thing with the appropriations process, which is moving forward in the House. Go ahead,
Sarah. I was going to say it makes a lot of sense with all the market functions that DOE does as an agency.
Yeah. It is interesting it's interesting that when DOE officials come to the Hill, they're often asked about EPA. I noticed that last week in an appropriations.
Maybe we can get rid of an agency.
Yeah. You find the FERC officials are generally smart enough to try to stay away from the Hill. But it's an interesting dynamic. It seems like nothing's getting done, that if we're going to continue to have these small fights, if people are going to continue to dig in, and if what started out as a fairly innocuous, non-polarizing energy efficiency bill. Everybody can agree that we should use energy efficiency, more intelligently, that we should deploy it more, that there's great potential there. This is becoming the vehicle for everything, everything energy. It would be highly interesting because given the dynamics of the two chambers, can anything come out? Is there even possible to get... Tyson, do you even see a conference somewhere on the distant horizon, or is that just too hopeful these days to think we can even get to a conference?
No, on this energy efficiency bill, I think that there's a good chance of getting to conference. Getting out of conference is another issue. it's all going to depend upon the amendments that are debated. But the bottom line is that it's disappointing that common sense bipartisan, or what should be bipartisan issues around energy efficiency have become this controversial and watered down. I mean, that's the upsetting thing. We're not seeing the kind of good congressional leadership that we need to see on this. I think we were talking earlier or Kevin mentioned that Obama didn't really talk about specifics of energy efficiency in his big climate speech. That would have been a good way to give Shaheen Portman the push it needed. So there's just been a lack of good leadership across the board on something that should be low-hanging fruit.
I don't think it's inherently doomed. One thing you have going for you is you have Republican leaders from industrial districts. These are folks who generally can take energy efficiency home and make something out of it. And they have to do everything that they've had to do with the Republican Party and its current bifurcation between right and extreme right. And they have to fight off the people who will say no to anything that looks like spending. But in Ohio, this plays. You know what? This is the sort of thing that industrial states want. And it sells. It doesn't sound like pork. It sounds like competitiveness. So a strong Senate showing might be enough to catalyze passage in the House.
Now, I'm interested, Kevin, what do you see as the strongest provisions of the bill? A lot of folks point towards the energy efficiency requirements, you know, at various levels of the economy and so on. Personally working in energy efficiency finance at times, you know, I'd like to see a little more money in some of the finance provisions because, you know, $5-10 million to state energy offices is not going to do an incredible amount, you know, if deployed into the right structures that then, you know, boom significant private capital off of it potentially. But, you know, it seems to be that when the bill got going, it was fairly modest and a good step forward, but they weren't trying to, you know, jump head over heels into the future. Are we going to see the debate basically turn the bill into something unwieldy? And if so, what would be the provision that you would point to in saying, but for anything else, keep this?
I think we've already lost probably one of the most relevant provisions, which was the loan guarantee. I'm one of the last few defenders of loan guarantees who would be Republican identified. But when they're properly deployed, they're an efficient mechanism for generating investment on the private sector side. Actually, the importance of the bill isn't even within the bill itself. I think it is paving the way. Two points make a line. We had very modest energy efficiency provisions at the end of the year last year. This would be the first affirmative action by a Congress moving on its own in a direction that could only gather momentum. I think that once enthusiasm proves out and plays politically at home, you have your chance to take a serious standards-based bill, a serious financing-based bill, and move it down the same corridor that's been opened by this one. But the standards are probably the most meaningful part of it, and they're not everything that efficiency advocates might have hoped for.
Tyson, what's the strongest part of the bill in your mind?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think a lot of the strongest provisions, as Kevin noted, were stripped out of it. When I still see a debate in the House, for example, where Representative Blackburn was railing against Department of Energy standards on ceiling fans as intrusive big government, that's just not a helpful part of the debate. And the fact is, we still have a significant chunk of Congress that sees any sort of government mandates around energy efficiency as something to fear rather than something to embrace.
It'd be fascinating if we could find out, you know, the rules behind those, because it seems to be quite hit or miss, and it seems to be that energy's political nature draws a lot of ideological statements that it might not otherwise.
The light bulbs. Remember the light bulbs?
That is a bit remarkable that, you know, you've had some of it. And also the fact that, as I think Democrats are looking at right now, understandably, there's enough fodder for YouTube, as folks have put it. There's enough fodder out there in statements from the conservative political segments where it's feasible to bring forth the anti-science framing, the anti-science argument, that they're just ignoring, you know, the facts, that they're ignoring the science. That far from true, but it's damaging that, you know, it's coloring the debate so significantly, just as the same where, you know, folks taking, you know, a stance that any type of further regulation in the energy sector must equal regressive costs, through the economy. Again, I am having a very hard time seeing how such extremely polarizing positions are going to allow for anything to come out. And as I heard someone say the other day, just your point, it's disappointing that as some of the provisions are being stripped out of this bill, that you're seeing other ones like the Keystone Amendment being suggested. It's almost as if they're, you know, the bill is, you know, being mutilated and you know, reformed into something else. As one person put it, I felt like, you know, the leadership was giving us a bit of a bait and switch. You know, putting this, you know, getting the bill through committee, everyone was excited in its present form, and now looking what's happening. Do you guys foresee, you know, the Senate floor to be a productive effort, or is this just one other grandstanding? Again, is this all about just the Hill and Congress becoming a press event and the real work being done at the agencies?
I think that it has the potential, but you're going to have stakeholders like GE, like the National Association of Manufacturers, really get public about this. And as Kevin framed it, it was perfect. It's about competitiveness. But you've got to have those stakeholders speaking up and leading the framing of this kind of legislation. And for the most part, they just haven't been there to talk proactively about bills. They've been there if they want to attack a bill. But the problem is that these key corporate stakeholders need to start engaging in productive ways that when we do have a bill that benefits many of their members, we've got to hear from them.
Are they just waiting for critical mass to ascertain that there's it's enough getting in, jumping in and beginning to push?
Almost certainly. I mean, so I brought up the compact fluorescent bulbs because it was an easy one for the folks who wanted to make a symbolic sacrifice to sacrifice. It's the long arm of the government reaching into your bathroom and making your wife look ugly. But this is actually, again, as Tyson says, this has an upside for the same constituents. This is to make their factory look pretty, to make their margins look slender, make their costs look slender, make their margins look fat.
Right.
But why would stakeholders jump in front of a massive political train right now? I would think that that's the problem. The problem is that you can't get people to come out for the bill, partially because it's weaker. You can't get people to come out for the bill from the industrial community because they don't want to be pilloried for picking a pig.
Right.
I think that both sides are kind of banking on the opposite of what you've just sort of put forward, which is that if you really take the very partisan argument directly to the voters, that eventually that'll yield dividends down the road. I mean, OFA, you know, Organizing for Action is targeting climate deniers in their districts. They're going to do a big action, you know, next month on that. And you know, the coal industry is doing similar things where they're doing just sort of outreach, saying, "Oh, the other guy is so bad." It's interesting whether that'll further polarize the argument and make legislation impossible, or whether it'll sort of lay the groundwork for eventual action because you'll embarrass the other side so much in their own district that maybe there will be movement. I'm not sure.
I'm hopeful that embarrassment within their own district is still a relevant concept on both sides of the aisle.
I would love to hear the coal industry rail against markets and how the free market and cheap natural gas is killing their jobs and ruining their industry, rather than regs. But I assume we probably won't hear that message.
Well, I mean, that's been, you know, one of the, obviously, the big game changers. And that's one of the things we're beginning to see. In my humble opinion, you know, gas, renewable energy, energy efficiency, the suite of clean energy technologies are really figuring out that they have much more alignment than they have opposition in terms of their interests and direction and how they deploy. One could argue that, you know, the future of the clean energy technology suite is going to pull in together, and it's hard when gas prices are this low. The folks who hurt the most are coal generators. It's one of those ironic realities of merit order dispatch in our power sector.
I wouldn't say it's the generators who hurt, Chris. I'd say it's the miners who hurt.
Well, that's taking it back to, you know, back upstream, and that's the generators are, you know, it's a bunch of steel, it's a factory, doesn't make for the greatest picture. The miners, though, that's real people with real families and, you know, real jobs in parts of the country that haven't seen other industries.
And it's a real fuel that really can be piled up in an inventory that you can see And one of the things that state regulators are still getting their heads around is that if they can't see the gas piled up, how do they know that reliability is going to be there? And they freak out a little bit because if everybody's going to be using gas for everything, then who's going to be paying to build the pipelines to bring it up? There's a lot of problems that coal solves, but coal hasn't done itself any favors, I don't think, because arguing that regulation is the problem obviously hasn't stopped them from exporting significantly overseas.
And that's going to be a dominant factor. Are we going to develop the technology here while continuing to export with the intention that it's our tons today, tomorrow it's going to be our clean coal technology?
I mean, the Obama administration has committed to clean coal in the past, but the problem is that it's still not ready for prime time. The capital costs are just overwhelming, and I just, especially with today's cheap gas and with declining cost curves for renewables, I just don't see, and particularly in this, fiscal austerity environment, I just don't see where clean coal fits in the federally backed portfolio. The private sector sure as heck isn't going to touch it. So, if we're not building new nukes, we sure as heck are not going to be building new clean coal plants.
Well, it's a challenge because we're still at, 48%. Are we down to 35 now? 36?
We got into the 30s last year.
That's
we're back
right.
up around 40.
We're back around 40 now. Okay, that's right.
And that's price driven.
And that's price driven. But our production stance in terms of at the mine mouth for tons being produced. Has not taken a significant nosedive.
It's increased.
In fact, the exports, so if you go from 2007, which was sort of the coal demand peak, it was kind of the demand peak for everything,
right.
And you ask, what's the delta now in what we're consuming? We're down about 200 million tons a year on production of about a billion and a half a million. So that's pretty significant. About half of that can go to gas. About half of that can go to demand contracting. And what are we exporting? We're up about 120 million tons a year in exports, okay, at sort of peak to trough, and probably net up this year only about 90 million relative to typical export levels. Why? Well, part of it is that coal demand overseas has softened, right? So we're reaching a point where if we can't move the coal out the West Coast to the market that wants it the most and is willing to reward it the highest, then some of the coal production that we're still delivering can't find its way out of the U.S. And here we get into an interesting problem. Now there are two stranded hydrocarbons in the U.S. that can't find world prices, both of which are artificially cheap and both of which are making life hard for your renewables friends.
Well, it's interesting because, again, as I was saying, I've long not seen gas and renewables in opposition. And I think that part of what gas prices are doing now in the marketplace makes it easier for the market to bear the increased costs of renewable deployment, which I would argue we're on the other side of that fence now, with cost reductions and going down and so on. In some ways, gas and renewables have already benefited each other significantly, and I think will go into the future. Again, part of the challenge, and one of the reasons I thought it was interesting that if you looked at Obama's climate plan, they couch the NSPS for existing and new pollutants under the chapter of deploying clean energy. It's not reducing pollutants, it's not it's the chapter of clean energy, and it's talking about the shift we're seeing in our power sector. As efficiency regulations promulgate, load is going to continue to stay fairly static or go down. If we continue to see more manufacturing pick up, there's ever increasing chance that manufacturing is going to be deploying CHP, going to be deploying advanced on-site generation, advanced on-site building management, and so on, and therefore not be as a large section of load on the grid as it used to be. It's going to be more dynamic. So we start getting more dynamic loads all around the country. The whole dynamic might change to keep repeating myself on the term dynamic. But the bottom line is that we might well be seeing a point where the suite of technologies that work not only at the utility scale but at the community scale and the campus scale are going to be the ones that accelerate. And there's a big question there as to where coal technology fits in. Because even clean coal that we're looking at these days, it's all talking about large central station, big plants. you know, I have yet to hear folks talk about, in the same way they might other types of technologies, community scale installations. Where you'd
of
be
clean
actually,
coal is the first I've heard of.
You'd be using coal. No, and that's the same point.
Your own gasifier.
But everyone else in the energy technology, including the nuclear industry, with pocket nukes and so on, you know, small modular reactor designs, everyone's beginning to look at that kind of level of deployment, except coal.
Well, there is a sort of a thermodynamic challenge.
You know, there is, without a doubt.
Trying to get a steam turbine to size around a heat source that you can keep in your home.
Indeed. But maybe in your district, I mean, think about it maybe at waste energy, you know, scale level, at you know, municipal or campus scale.
But they tend to be lower thermal efficiency than big advanced plants, and part of that is that you want to react as much surface with as much heat as possible for combustion.
Exactly. And Stoker plants are going the way of the dodo.
But you can get to 26% biomass, and then you hit 1,500 pounds per megawatt hour, assuming your biomass is carbon neutral. So there is a solution that keeps some of these coal plants going. And I suppose, Chris, if you let me change the subject on you just a little bit, this whole notion of carbon neutrality of biomass might start to become important in an NSPS world, especially for those coal plants.
If they have a fluidized bed, let it come. The flex fuel aspects are very interesting, and a lot of folks have noted that coal heading out to the Pacific Rim from the West Coast and such is not the only solid fuel that's picking up its exports out of the United States. We're seeing ever more demand for our biomass fuel, pelletized or torrefied, heading to blue water, going over to Europe, where the EU emissions trading system assigns it a wonderfully fantastic zero emissions factor. Now, there's a big question here as to whether it deserves the same thing. And Bill, who usually joined us, who our best wishes are as having a speedy recovery for a back injury, I'm pretty sure Bill would say that you have to take an incredibly close look at that life cycle to ensure that it's not something that is adding net emissions into the atmosphere. That issue is still, and has been for what, you know, 3-4 years now, been up in the air. I know, Kevin, you feel strongly about biomass and the role it should play here. Are we going to, I mean, do we have a prediction for the retrofitting of plants to go flex fuel?
Well, flex fuel plants are a solution. On the other hand, I think it's kind of crocked. If you look at what we ask people to do, it's to stop using the energy-dense fuel, use a less energy-dense fuel, move back from the industrial age to the stone age. It's kind of creepy, but it works. As long as you have sustainable environmental practices associated with the harvesting of the biomass. And I wish Bill were here, because I think he might talk about that. But the point is, it is a solution. It's a solution on which a lot of the country relies. EPA gave backed compliance to the Wolverine coal plant, 595 megawatt plant, for 5% co-firing of biomass. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was established as an effective way to mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions. This is happening. So what we have is a regulatory framework where we might be firing up some wood, might be burning firewood in our coal plants, headed down the pike at us pretty soon. And I think we should at least talk about whether or not folks think this is a good idea.
Well, a lot of it comes down to the question of whether the feedstock upstream for that biomass is being done in a sustainable rotation, whether it's being grown such that what it sequesters is you know, that you're replanting and growing, basically that you're replanting and growing new biomass at the, you know, in the same, you know, areas and locations, so that you can make that case that I'm pulling from the atmosphere, putting it back in the atmosphere, and pulling from the atmosphere again, as opposed to, I'm sure Bill would say, when you dig up something that was around quite some time ago and didn't really have a chance to come in or out of the atmosphere anytime lately, and putting it back into the cycle.
EPA's got to decide now. So the court said that they're effectively required to come down on whether or not biomass is carbon neutral.
Same stuff, all about vintage. Tyson.
I don't really have anything to add on biomass, so.
I think part of the argument that he might make if he were here is that even if you do plant brand new little trees in the same space, even if you plant more than one brand new little tree, it's centuries before it's sequestering the same amount of carbon that whatever you just cut down to. I don't know. I mean, I was curious when you were talking.
Well, it depends what forest you're in. There's some forests that can do it in 35 years.
I suppose. I mean, and that's part of the calculus. I don't know. I mean, I guess EPA, it is up to EPA now to figure out what it's doing. because the courts have decided that. I was told by someone, reporting something that, it's quite sustainable if what you're really using is just sort of waste product. But you have to be careful about how you classify waste product, because there is a certain amount of bramble that you can basically collect that otherwise would have gone to nothing that you can
use. Gone up as methane.
I don't know exactly how that works or how you'd make sure that you knew where it came from, but...
Again, it's fascinating that an industrial society would start sending out hordes of people to collect brambles to replace the coal they might dig out with a machine. But okay, I mean, if that's the solution we're going to pick, that's the solution we're going to pick.
Well, sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of trends in society, and sometimes going back to the older ways. Again, it's not as if, you know, those brambles are then going to be burned in a, you know, in an open pot, in open flame, or so on. But, you know, they're
compressed, dehydrated,
exactly,
shaped, and shipped.
Yeah. Or as you said, thrown into a fluidized bed boiler and
here in the U.S.
And combusted as part of, you know, your best available control technology showing.
Well, since Bill's not here to fight with.
I know. It's fun to put words in Bill's mouth while Bill isn't here.
That's
but,
right.
You know, unfortunately, you know, we can't get him. Now, let me ask folks for a prediction. We talked about the Senate energy bill, which I guess it's appropriate. We shouldn't just call it the Senate Energy Efficiency Bill anymore, because it appears to be coming the Senate Energy Bill. Going to get to conference anytime before Thanksgiving? Tyson, prediction.
Before Thanksgiving? Probably not.
Gene?
I'm following a couple of the amendments, but I'm not really covering the bill, so I don't want to make a prediction.
You want to make a prediction? Guess?
But maybe not out of conference. I don't know.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Two conference. I like the conference. That's a good procedure.
No, not before Thanksgiving. We have drama and much fighting to do about other things. Debt ceiling, for example, the annual appropriations measures. Those things tend to crowd one's ability to confer bicamerally. So I suspect we're probably going to see this in the first quarter next year.
And one can always hope for more bicameral conferring. It happens not as much as one might regularly see. But then again, for those of us who've been around D.C. for some time, it feels like, quite frankly, after the turn of the century and the unfortunate events of September 11th, there really hasn't been normalcy. Not a normal appropriation cycle, not a normal budget cycle. It's been problematic.
That's normal.
And that's, I guess, the problem with...
We
now think of it as normal, and that's part of the issues of D.C. God forbid we follow the Chamber's processes. Well, listen, to all of you, thank you for joining us. On behalf of the American Bar Association's Energy, Environmental Markets, and Finance Committee and the American University's Washington College of Law, thanks for joining us for the Hot Air Show. We'll see you next time in the heat.